Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later on in the program, we're going to hear from our good friend Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London. But first, we're going to hear from Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch and Richard Abelafi of the Thiel Group Consultancy. Guys, welcome back.
Great to be here, Vago.
Always good to be here, Vago.
All right, Ron. Let's first talk about 737. May 23 is the big looming date, but we also had a little bit of news flow on that. And for anybody who's listening, you are taping this from the lounge at O'Hare Airport, so that tinkling you can hear in the background is you in the lounge. Talk to us a little bit about what we know more about 737. And Boeing's efforts and the FAA's efforts to get the airplane, the MAX 8 and 9, back in flight.
So May 23rd will be a meeting that the FAA has called, where they're trying to pull together a group of international regulatory authorities to try to get everybody on the same board, if you will, in terms of getting certification for the airplane, and more importantly, trying to focus everyone on how the airplane will go back into service. So, you know, so one of the things that, you know, Boeing's been pretty clear on is, you know, there's certification, but certification isn't necessarily entry back into service or return to service. So I think those will be two topics on, you know, what the other authorities want to see, what they're looking for, and return to service. You know, one of the areas that there's been some press on already about the return to service is the training requirement. That the difference training requirement on the new platform, and as of our conversation right now, there's still only 15 MAX simulators in the world. So that could be a bottleneck or not. We'll see how that goes. So that's an important meeting to keep an eye on. And then, you know, earlier this week, there was some discussion around angle of attack, sensor failure, mismatch, and, you know, what was, you know, communicated by Boeing to the airlines on, you know, was the system working? Was the system not working? Who wanted the system? So there was a lot of, confusion around that. So I would say that's kind of where we are. A bit of a holding pattern until May 23. And then hopefully from there, maybe we'll have some insight onto when we might be able to start to see some things return to service. We're thinking probably no earlier than mid to late July at best.
It was on the last program, and sadly you couldn't join us. Richard, Sash, and I talked a little bit about that circular, or the statement from Boeing about the angle of attack sensor not being integral in terms of the flight of controlling or safely controlling an airplane. Richard, how do you see some of the news flow, where we're going to be on the international certification, right? I mean, the FAA wants to do this in sort of an international way to get the airplane back in flight. And also, you know, you had a little bit of time to reflect and read and talk to folks about the angle of attack statement and what that means. For a while, it looked like Boeing was being somewhat, or transmitting a somewhat more penitent or apologetic tone. That seems a little bit to have worn off. Give us your sense on some of the things we've been hearing this week, including a couple of the news stories, which, again, were not terribly complimentary.
Yeah, you know, and Boeing seems to have clammed up again and seems to have been taken over yet again by the lawyers. I mean, they really need to be very clear about the role MCAS played and, well, their part in designing and integrating this MCAS and the training associated with it and whatever else. And I still think this whole debate was not at all well served by their statement last weekend. I mean, I think in a vacuum, it was certainly a true statement, except that it's really far more necessary than they implied because of the reliance of the MCAS system upon exactly one sensor. So I don't see any reason that they put out that statement. I don't think it served any purpose whatsoever. Having said that, the world is moving on in getting this plane ready. And this May 23rd meeting that Ron talks about is, of course, hugely important because it will show just how robust the world system of aircraft certification reciprocity is. If people show up, there's going to be dozens and dozens of different groups worldwide coming, and they're listening and they're keenly taking notes, and their exceptions to the FAA are relatively minor, then, you know, the system is still working, and that's good. But if there's a lot of pushback and a lot of demands, and a lot of, yeah, well, we'll take this home and study it for the next weeks, months, possible years. That's going to be a real warning sign too.
How problematic were the stories that ran suggesting that Boeing knew that this was going to be a problem and was a problem with the jet a lot earlier than we've been led to believe?
Yeah, I mean, if only looking at it from the optics standpoint, it isn't great. I mean, it just increases the onus on Boeing to come clean and explain what went wrong. You know, getting back to Ron's great question a couple weeks ago, how did this happen? And there's absolutely nothing that came out this week that was terribly complimentary of that, especially in light of the fact that they're just not talking about their role in all of this.
Ron, your sense on some of those stories, because we had also heard, right, that the company after the Lion Air crash thought that this might be an issue and not the right kind of guidance may have gone out to folks and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, like Richard suggested, I mean, it just makes kind of everything a little more complicated. It seems like every weekend we have to brace ourselves for a trickle of, you know, kind of unfavorable disclosure. You just got to wonder what's going to happen this weekend. One of the questions I have for the company that I guess at some point I'll ask is, you know, knowing what they know now, what would they have done differently? That's something I'd really like to know. But that disclosure about, them knowing that there was maybe some sort of system failure is the wrong word, but I mean that the sensor connection wasn't quite right. I would imagine, I mean, that's meaningful, right? So, I mean, we'll see.
Richard, let me bring you into the conversation. IATA has put its passenger air traffic numbers out, and it doesn't look pretty, does it?
Yeah, 3.1% year-over-year growth was the worst we've seen in quite a while, and we'd gotten used to some exceptional, way above trend numbers in the 6% and 7% range, and all of a sudden 3.1%, they blamed a little bit of it on the timing of Easter when that got captured, but they also were very clear that some of this is macroeconomic, you know, and there are concerns about the downshift in world trade, there's concerns about a possible trade war, there's concerns about all sorts of stuff. 3.1% is really as far from stellar as you could possibly get. If we're in for an extended period of this kind of dismal performance, yeah, that's really dangerous. My assumption right now is it's a combination. It's a one-off. We're going to return to at trend 5-6%, something in that, in reasonably short order. But in terms of less than magisterial data points that didn't exactly make people's day, week, or month, that wasn't great.
That is the word of the podcast, less than magisterial. It almost sounds like you're writing for The Economist there. Ron, what's your interpretation of those numbers?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about approximately 3% growth after having about 5.5% growth last month, it was up the month before that about 6.5%, and the month before that was in the mid-5s, not that we track it. A 3% will not be well received by investors, right? I mean, it'll just stoke fears that, you know what, you know, maybe we're getting to a period of slowing traffic growth. And the reason, you know, maybe it's 1 month, it's not, maybe we'll see, but, you know, we're trending, you know, the direction has been, the point being, you know, we were at mid-5s, 6, mid-5s, 3. Are we trending off a pattern where we were seeing kind of, you know, 6% traffic growth plus or minus 50 basis points to something lower than that? And, you know, higher math, you know, half of 6 is 3, right? So that's a lot lower, right? So I don't know, you know, I mean, it's something for sure the market will be keeping an eye on, right? Because everybody's aftermarket growth models are predicated on some level of aftermarket growth. And my sense is most of the market wasn't thinking numbers that level. So per Richard's comment, if we were to get, you know, 2 to 3 months of low single digit air traffic growth, that would be a surprise for sure.
How is the China trade dispute going to be affecting the economy, Ron? And Richard, I mean, you know, how does this you know, it's been a while since China has bought an airplane from the United States. I just, you know, it was a good observation to make. How is all of this going to affect things? I know the negotiations are still ongoing as we tape this. There's, you know, the meetings broke for the weekend without an agreement. You know, the United States has imposed a higher degree of tariffs, which ultimately the American consumer has to pay. I understand that the administration's strategy is that we're a healthier economy and can break the Chinese. But then there's that whole, you know, face thing that, you know, China's a great nation. It's a great power and it doesn't like being muscled around and it doesn't want to yield, you know, and make it seem like the United States has won this confrontation. You know, where are we going with this and how is it likely to affect the economy and markets?
Yeah, right. I mean, so, I mean, what we've seen, the impact on markets is pretty straightforward, right? So as the news flow has gotten maybe a little more severe, a little worse in terms of, the trade action might actually really take place. You've seen the market be very volatile this week, right? We've seen some big moves in the S&P kind of around this news flow. When the news flow got, you know, a little more positive, market, you know, came back. And when the news flow was a little more negative, market sold off. Not humongous moves, but, you know, reasonable moves. I think there is some already discounted in the market that, you know, this is going to be a volatile situation, if that makes sense. You know, for the broader economy, right, not that I'm an economist, so let me just kind of preface it with that. I'm sort of an airplane guy, but trade wars aren't good for anybody, right? So, you know, I mean, it would it have an impact on both our economy and the Chinese economy and to some degree, for sure, a global economy? Yeah. The view that, you know, the U.S. is less dependent on the Chinese and the Chinese are dependent on the U.S., depending on how you look at it, that might very well be the case, right? I mean, would it impact consumers? For sure. But I think there's a school of thought, for sure, broader than just the administration, that the U.S. economy is in many ways more robust than the Chinese economy. So we'll see. Hopefully, we don't have to take that to the test. On the aerospace front, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because as you said, the Chinese have not bought an airplane from Boeing in quite some time. There is a feeling that as part of this, you know, a trade negotiation, that aircraft could be part of it, because ultimately our largest exporter and our largest export to China for sure is aircraft, right? So it seems almost unreasonable to assume that aircraft wouldn't be some part of it. What gets a little more complicated and interesting, if you will, is as we look at the 737 MAX, its recertification, its reentry into service, does that somehow become part of the politics of all this too, right? I don't know. I mean, there's some folks that think it may, but there's a lot of moving pieces. Why don't I hand it over to Richard there?
Yeah, thanks, Rob. You know, I can't imagine how these things aren't at least somewhat linked. Not that to accuse the Chinese of politicizing safety and certification issues, but I don't think they're above it. The CAAC has a bit of a connection with government. As a matter of fact, it is the government, and there really aren't any firewalls. Now, having said all that, and being mindful of the concern, I think there's a tremendous upside here if somehow it could all be wrapped up in a neat little bow by around sometime this summer, with the administration negotiating something settled, which I wouldn't put huge money on, but on the other hand, you can't rule it out. And at the same time, the Chinese recertifying the MAX, and at the same time saying, yeah, per Ron, we are massively underordered here. We just placed a large Airbus order, but it only covers a year of our intake. We would also place an order for, say, 300 MAXs. And it all comes together in a massive upside for Boeing. Now, what are the odds of the administration actually reaching a amicable solution that worked to the interest of U.S. industry? 20, 30%? I don't know. What are the odds that the Chinese go along with all of this and include the MAX? Well, if they agree to be friendly to the Trump administration or perhaps even cave, to be cynical, to the Trump administration on the trade issues, then yeah, the MAX would be a logical beneficiary.
One of the things I might add, Bago, is when you think about the trade dispute with China, from my perspective, and I don't think I'm alone in this, there's more going on here than just a trade dispute. There's also issues around national security, where if you were to think about the situation where if the United States were to mobilize for some sort of military effort, And if indeed that military effort was against China and China is part of the United States supply chain, how would you do that, right? So I think there's also a realignment going on of, you know, U.S., you know, the U.S. Supply chain for everything from rare earth metals to you name it, regarding, you know, national security. And I think that sometimes gets overlooked when people think about the Chinese trade dispute.
Exactly. I mean, it's also, right, a proxy battle between Beijing and the United States at a time when tensions are running high between two, or running higher or building, perhaps, between two great powers. Time is running out, and we've got a lot more stuff to talk about, including potential Navy and Marine Corps interest in the Boeing Saab TX, Canada and the F-35, as well as the U.S. Air Force and its continually changing light attack experiment. Richard, let's start with the TX. Well, let's take all of those, right? I mean, so let me have you wash through them and then get Ron's take on it, because it was kind of a very action-packed week.
Yeah, I guess you could call it big news in the trainer market, which is not normally a market segment that matters one whit. Big trouble in a place you've never heard of, or, you know, something like that. What was interesting about the TX Trainer Award is that the Air Force locked in the amazingly great pricing it got for pretty much all of its requirements, you know, 351 program of record, but with options covering through 475, all they could ever need, really. So any relief Boeing can get from that, the incredibly great pricing they gave the Air Force, is welcome. And, you know, there are 200 or so T-45s that will one day need to be replaced. The TX has a Navy motor, the F-404. That's certainly good. It might take longer than people like for the T-45 replacement process to get started. But when it does, hey, there's the potential relief here of 200 reasonably priced T-45 replacements helping Boeing. Also, in addition to the TX news, there was the Air Force deciding to move forward to the light attack replacement requirement, which I regard as seriously ill-advised. The idea of procuring small numbers of aircraft, which will no doubt be useful in the event we are in Afghanistan forever, but are completely useless anywhere else, except for maybe Chad, I find kind of bizarre. But nevertheless, they're going ahead. They're going to get a few more Super Tucanos, and they're going to get also some AT-6s just to make people happy or something. Either way, it's good news for people who build light attack trainers.
I mean, I know that the Air Force has said they're going to buy both, but doesn't that make the decision even worse, because you don't then get fleet-wide commonality for whatever airplanes you're buying? Wouldn't it make better sense just to get these in a batch of the same model?
Any doubt people had about the politicization of the light attack requirement is immediately removed by the fact that they're buying both. In other words, responding to political pressure by making an incredibly illogical fleet planning decision. Yes, it would make sense to buy, if you must buy a few dozen of these things, and make the Air Force basically unique among first world developed countries in having these things at all, then at least buy just one kind.
Ron, let me get your take on both of those, and then I want to get both of you talking about the F-35, because I know you got to get on an airplane in a little bit.
So yeah, to follow on to Richard's comments, you know, on the TX, yeah, I mean, if, you know, they can sell some to the Navy, that would be great, right? And when you look at what they did in terms of pricing the contract and what they've said to, I think, the market, and just kind of more broadly of how big they think the market is for these aircraft, you know, at a minimum, they have to be thinking that they can sell some of these to the Navy, right? Being the incumbent with the, you know, potentially replacing the T-45s, and that would make a lot of sense. I mean, it makes the decision to kind of give the hyper good deal that they did to the Air Force make more sense. And I think that would be positively received. On the light attack piece, I mean, it's a lot of investors don't really think about it all that much. I mean, it can move the needle potentially a little bit for Textron. And, you know, splitting a buy between, you know, both the Textron aviation product and the Super Tucano from Embraer, per Richard's comments, I don't know how much sense that really makes, right? You're not buying that many of them, and I don't know why you'd want to mix fleet, but, you know, it kind of is what it is.
And we should say Sierra Nevada is partnered, bringing that airplane, the Embraer airplane, to the market. Let me ask a quick question, though. You know, the Saab guys had sort of hinted that, you know, they had thought through the design and that the TX could be modified to be a Navy jet. Have they formally come out and made a statement regarding that, that they have put, you know what I mean? I mean, the big problem with the Goshawk, the T-45, was the Hawk was never designed to be a Navy plane, and the modifications of it were kind of expensive and costly and added a lot of weight to the airplane. If you've already thought it through, it's a lot easier of a process. Do we have any information from either of you whether or not that's actually been thought through?
Yeah, or is this going to be a... Boeing hasn't come out to the investor community and, you know, suggested that, you know, that that's the case. But my guess was they wouldn't anyway until they would need to do so. You know what I mean? So,
Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine they would have to. I mean, I'm sure they did an elaborate study of what they would need to make things whole just because of the very aggressive price they submitted on TX. And there are two ways to make it whole. And one is Navy and Marines, and the other is exports. So I'm sure they were pretty mindful of the requirement.
Yeah, one interesting thing I might add, this is sort of a tangent, but related. Investors were concerned after the win on TX and MQ-25 that, you know, somehow the rules were changed for bidding on defense contracts. But both, you know, in the period since then, both Boeing and Northrop have suggested on GBSD, which they're both going for, that it's not a price shootout like it was for TX, but, you know, that the Air Force is being thoughtful in a different way about that contract, really around best value, but not necessarily just best price.
Well, and also, lest we forget, Boeing also took a rather sizable charge that also alarmed Wall Street, as I recall. Okay, but it's still outstanding whether or not the airplane itself has been designed for that upgrade in the future, and whether or not it can be accomplished economically, or whether it's going to be something that, given the fundamental structural differences of a tail-hooked airplane, so that's going to be an interesting space to watch. Even if the airplane may be ideal in a lot of its characteristics, at the end of the day, it's the question of whether or not the beefier landing gear, keel, and other structural components, not to mention the front of the airplane, because we use a launch bar, you know, I mean,
yes,
that's a, you know, it is not a small cost or effort involved in that. Let's go to the F-35. So walk us through what's going on here, because Canada, you know, it looked like Canada, even though it's been an observer participant in the F-35 program since its inception, it was going to buy it. It's not, then there was a political row over pricing. You know, where are we now in the latest information flow, Richard?
It's kind of interesting. You know, the idea of the F-35 to start with was to sort of break the paradigm of offsets and mandatory work shares. And they just basically said, look, if you're good at what you do, we'll give you a contract. And Canadian companies, sure enough, earned contracts. And now you had the return of the Canadian fighter competition. Hopefully some of the political headwinds are out of the way from the Boeing trade dispute. But in theory, you know, it should be a wide open field, except that they at first demanded offsets. And then, of course, Lockheed Martin and the U.S. said, wait a minute, we've already given you contracts on the basis of competitiveness, not, you know, demanded work share. And it looked pretty critical for a few minutes, but then a day or two ago, the Canadian government said, fine, you get an exception, we'll let you compete. And this, to me, puts the F-35 back in the front-running position for the Canadian requirement.
Ron?
I agree with what Richard said. I mean, if you look at kind of the shifting landscape, if you will, getting Canadians back in while the, you know, the Turks might be falling out, you know, it's a shift of the international piece. Clearly, if it plays out that way, it'll be positively received by investors.
Okay, and we've got about a minute and a half to 2 minutes left. What's up with Bombardier and this rush to get out of large aerostructures, Richard?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, frankly, Bombardier could use the money, and they're selling off anything that isn't core, which means anything that isn't trains and business jets. At the same time, you've got by several companies, basically anyone who's not Boeing, a realization that there's no reason to supply your own large aerostructures, so why not just let someone of the experts handle it. But what's really fascinating is that Belfast has some wonderful technologies and very interesting resin transfer and fusion and other interesting aerostructures work or capabilities. And obviously, you've got them as a key supplier to the Airbus A220, formerly the C-Series. And Airbus could probably leverage those technologies elsewhere. So there's a couple of interesting tests. One, will Airbus see the value in this and purchase it and possibly even use this technology, this RTI technology, as the template for an upgrade for their existing wings moving forward? And simultaneously, will the Chinese say, hey, this is an interesting bit of IP we could get, possibly at a very good price, maybe we'll buy it. And if, as a matter of fact, I would argue if the price is a few hundred million and the Chinese don't buy it, then we know that the Chinese really aren't as serious as we think they are about acquiring aerospace technology.
Or whether or not they will be allowed to buy it, right? I mean, that's another issue, especially the pressure that Washington is putting on London not to buy Huawei technology. Ron, anything to add on that before you have to get on your flying carpet?
Yeah. What I might also add is, you know, the Belfast facility, besides the resin technology for the wings, they also are a shop that makes nacelles, right? So it's a, you know, the history of Short Brothers was, you know, the long history of making nacelles, among other things, right? So, I mean, it's an active nacelle business. They've got the wing technology. Per Richard's comments, you could really imagine a scenario where it ends up in Airbus's hands or an Airbus supplier's hands. And again, just kind of reiterating one of Richard's comments, I mean, one of the key reasons that they're doing this is it's just not core anymore. And, you know, the current team at Bombardier has really been trying to focus the company on business aviation and transportation, aka trains. So that's the why. And, you know, whose hands it ends up in, I think will be ultimately be pretty interesting.
I've got my money on Airbus. Once Airbus acquired the C-Series, they have an insatiable demand for aerostructures right now. So that's where my bet is. Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks again, Vago. Great to be here.
My pleasure, Vago. Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor. The Defense and Aerospace Report is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. And joining us from London on the second half of our podcast is Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners. Sash, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago. Good to be here.
As we heard in the top of the show, we talked about 737. We talked a little bit about the Navy and Marine Corps interest in the Boeing Saab TX trainer that the United States Air Force has picked. And I know that you went to the Saab management meeting. Let's talk and follow up a little bit on the conversation that Ron, Richard, and I had about Bombardier and the sale of its aerostructures business and how you see it's going into, you know, from your standpoint, it's sort of an emerging pattern among large companies that are divesting themselves of this capability. Talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing across the industry.
Okay. I mean, I think that the Bombardier decision was a surprise in timing, but not actually in direction. It's that we're talking about it this week that is the news, but probably less the action itself. I think that what is really interesting, though, is that Bombardier's decision to exit from this aerostructures business is part of a much broader trend globally. To put it simply, everybody significant is a seller of their aerostructures business. Very few people are willing buyers. What does that tell us? That tells us that the primes, Boeing and Airbus, have squeezed too far. They have pushed too far. Partnering for success for Boeing, Power 8 for Airbus were designed to transfer risk to the subcontractors and margins back to the prime contractors. And they've clearly succeeded very well. You know, Airbus and Boeing are materially more profitable than they were 5, let alone 10 years ago. The problem is that their subcontractors are not. And as a consequence, we're seeing a lot of companies selling or spinning off aerostructures businesses or just being very unhappy with the businesses they've got, but they don't know what to do with them. I can give you five examples, really, almost without taking breath. Leonardo are stuck in a very, very difficult couple of contracts, one for the Bombardier C-Series, now the A220, the other for the Boeing 787. Nobody who talks to Leonardo would think that this is a business they really want to be in, but they're effectively stuck in this at the moment. Dassault sold their Sabka business, or rather have said they're going to spin their Sabka business. Sabka is a Belgian subcontractor. It's effectively the Belgian national champion in aerostructures. Dassault's going to spin that off. They just don't want to be involved in that sort of business now. Melrose, who acquired GKN at the beginning of last year, are clearly looking to sell, divest, restructure, particularly the UK aerostructure side of it. They are hampered by the fact that the UK government would be unbelievably unhappy with that, and they can't find buyers for that. Bombardier are looking to sell particularly the huge Belfast facility, and General Electric sold Middle River Aircraft, the nacelles thrust reversers business. That closed last week.
Which VT Systems bought?
I'm saying Singapore Technologies is the parent.
Oh, excuse
that's
me,
right.
ST. That's right, ST.
Yeah, but, ST. But they're the parent of VT Systems. So lots of sellers, many, many fewer buyers. I think the primes have pushed too hard. And I think that as a consequence, we're going to see more pressure than the primes think for a reversal of this. I don't think Boeing, when they launch NMA, if they launch NMA, are going to be able to get subcontractors like, then it was Vought and Mitsubishi and Leonardo to stump up and take an immense amount of risk in terms of doing turnkey work on the fuselage. I actually think they're going to have to pay their subcontractors more. And that really is not in any analyst's forecast at the moment. But as I said, I think we're awash with sellers, very, very few buyers for aerostructures globally.
Do you think that Airbus ends up, my suggestion in the first segment, as you know, was that, Airbus may be a buyer of that, given how much demand they do have for aerostructures. Do you think that at the end of the day, that would be something that would be appealing to
they
Airbus?
Want to buy an, I think they want to buy an aerostructures business like they want a hole in the head, but do they have any choice? Probably much less than you might think. And if it's a choice between the Bombardier business going to the Chinese, which I think is almost inconceivable, the technology in that is just too sensitive, or indeed the Bombardier business, being sort of run down and failing as a supplier, then Airbus has got a track record of stepping in to help its suppliers, get through difficult patches. I think they would have to do that if the A220 program is to succeed. The Belfast business is just far too fundamentally important to Airbus for them to let it go to a weak buyer, or indeed just to be sort of managed down.
And as we've talked on this program, I mean, we do think that the C-Series airplanes, the A220, is just a tremendous, tremendous airplane. Let's talk a little bit about the Saab management meeting. Saab is one of those companies that, pound per pound, size per size. I mean, I don't think there's any company that quite punches at its weight class and its ability to engineer and develop cutting-edge jets, submarines, missiles, radars, and certainly I think that the Boeing Saab TX has, I think it's safe to say a very large dose of Swedish DNA in it. Talk to us a little bit about what you picked up at the management meeting.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I have to pinch myself. Every time I look at Saab's revenue line, which is roughly, it was 33 billion last year, 35 billion next year, I have to pinch myself and remember you've got to divide that by 8 to get the dollar number. Actually, when you look at what Saab produces, it should be that $33, $35 billion in, of real money, given that they're doing combat aircraft, they're doing defense electronics, they're a fantastic radar company. They make, state-of-the-art conventional submarines, anti-armor weapons, missiles, the whole gamut. It's a very, very competent company with a very, very small turnover base.
I am going to dive in and tell you that I do believe Swedish crowns are real money. Swedish kroners are real money, but go on. I see the point you're trying to make.
I stand corrected. It's real money. It's just very small real money.
Yes. But very lovely money. But you were saying.
Saab is in a sort of turnaround process at the moment. Not industrially. They won a ton of business about 5 years ago with the launch of the Gripen program, with exports to Brazil as well as a domestic program in Sweden for the Gripen E, the A26 submarine, GlobalEye, which is this much underrated airborne early warning system currently being built for the United Arab Emirates, and now TX. The problem is that everything was going well, and then they had a rights issue last year, which just killed the share price. And management are sort of, I think, you know, are still on a charm offensive to try and persuade people that the money they raised in the rights issue, six billion Swedish crowns, will be well spent. It wasn't a distress rights issue, i.e., you know, they did it because they thought the timing was good, not because they were absolutely gasping for the cash. And that, you know, that's one we can discuss for a long time. And that the business is actually going to grow faster as a result of that rights rather than not. Now, what I thought was interesting about the comments they were making this week was they were very, very bullish. But I mean, specifically, and I'll just sort of go through a couple of points that really sort of, you know, got my interest. One is that Sweden is likely to decide to keep 60 of the, you know, the in-service Gripen CD aircraft in service probably until about the mid-2030s. That sounds like it's slightly bad news for Saab because they would have liked to have sold 60 new Gripen E's to double the size of the Swedish fleet. But actually, the way Saab are selling it, the good news there is that what that does is that keeps the Gripen CD fresh for all of the customers that it currently has. Right. Czech Republic, Hungary, Thailand.
South Africa.
And so I think they actually are rather optimistic that they can now export, you know, sell or offer for export both the Gripen CD, which is very definitely at the cheaper and more cheerful end of the market, and for those customers who want the top end, Gripen E as well. I think it'd be very good if they were able to keep production up at a decent rate. If you look at Gripen E, what I think is fascinating there is the learning curve is clearly really impressive. They reckon they're going to get towards the bottom of the learning curve in as few as 30 aircraft. Normal program, that would be nearly 200. And that suggests a, you know, this is a learning curve of the order of 65%. Normal program, it would be 85%. That's very impressive. And this comes back to the point you were making about TX. Saab is just very good at running a digital design and manufacturing combat aircraft aerostructures business. If you look at TX in the back, it sure as hell looks like a rather small version of Gripen. And I think Saab has, you know, has managed to carry those skills across onto the Boeing program. What I find interesting about Gripen E is I think they're in a very strong position in Switzerland. I think Switzerland would be really disappointing if they lost it, frankly. It's probably the best single program for them at the moment. And they're, you know, they're very coy. They don't want to sort of blow any of their sort of their bids. But I mean, they did say they think they've got a much better solution now than they had in the previous competition in 2010. Remember, in 2010, Gripen NG, as was, won. There was just this bizarre referendum that overthrew things.
Well, it was a bizarre referendum that was, you know, I mean, there was, I think you could say, some Dassault and Eurofighter fingerprints in it to get the decision upturned.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. So, you know, Gripen E, they're clearly on the cusp of delivering the first aircraft, you know, to Brazil and Switzerland this year. Production deliveries really pick up next year, and that should be good for cash flow. And then if you turn to TX, what I find fascinating about TX there is that they are absolutely adamant that they have got a good contract with Boeing. They make money on the contract. They were always going to make money on the contract, despite the fact that Boeing clearly is, you know, was going to be in forward loss on that. I think Boeing has learned a great deal about, it's not even lean manufacturing. I think lean manufacturing is now it's a given in any competent combat aircraft business, but it's digital, it's DDM, digital design and manufacturing. Saab right. clearly, you know, way ahead of a lot of the other companies in that.
You know, I mean, just to parenthetically add a point, I mean, Håkan Buska, who was, you know, the highly capable chief executive of Saab and his team, we're talking about model-based design in terms of the framework of the program, both for the learning curve on the A26, which they said would be, you know, three subs, Just like I remember many years ago, Holcomb telling me, you know, hey guys, our learning curve is going to be 30 jets. And that's probably on the outside. And at the time, everybody was saying they would be completely nuts on it. But, you know, increasingly you hear more and more American contractors talking about the merits and benefits of a model-based design approach. So once again, I mean, you see Saab being kind of ahead of the power curve compared with contractors that are literally 10 or more times their size, don't you?
Yeah, it's one of the things I find astonishing about Saab, frankly. They are clearly, it is clearly a very, very well-managed company that has achieved things in terms of the transition to digitalization that most of the big OEMs that we look at are still struggling with. There's quite another interesting thing about TX that I thought really struck me as well, was just the degree. I mean, they've announced that they've got they're going to do most of their manufacturing in the US. I think they're delighted just to have a degree of sort of US dollar offset. But they were quite open about the fact that TX enables them to get grip and costs down. Which is probably something that Boeing wasn't necessarily aware of. But the reason for this is that everything that Saab builds on TX has got the same subcontractors on it as they have on Gripen. But those subcontractors are now delivering into a program that's 3 to 4 times the size. And they hand back some of those volume discounts back into the Gripen program again. And that's really a very, very elegant way of looking at the spin-offs for Saab of the TX program. TX basically makes Gripen even more competitive than it already is.
And that plant is going to be in Indiana, which the companies have announced. And Sash, we're running a little short on time, and you had a point to make about the Tempest program.
Yeah, I mean, again, this was sort of spin-off from some of the comments that Saab were making. But it's quite remarkable the degree to which Saab as a company, Sweden as a government, are focused on the UK's Tempest future combat aircraft program, way ahead of any interest in the Franco-German SCAF FCAS program. Saab management were really open about the fact that with Tempest, they have a good relationship with BAE industrially. They have had for 25 years, frankly. And that they would get a top table position on Tempest. And they would probably have a very, very similar relationship to BAE as they have to Boeing on TX, where very significant parts of the aircraft come direct from Saab. Wonderful throwaway line, which was that the offer that they were getting very, very informally from the Franco-German side was analogous to, why don't you just go off and build the front landing gear? And they just saw that as being a derisory offer compared to, effectively being in the cockpit or, being in the control room of a ship for Tempest. So I think, they're in Tempest already. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what comes out of this relationship, probably at REACT this year in July.
It is utterly fascinating, and equally fascinating is that that the Swedes didn't fall off the Apple truck yesterday. Clearly, Sash, thanks very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure, good to be here.
And thanks to all of you for joining us this week as well. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Check out our gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Navy League's Sea Airspace Conference and Trade Show outside Washington, where our coverage was sponsored by GE Marine, Huntington Ingalls Industries, and Leonardo DRS. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report. That's at DefAero Report. And like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is sponsored by Bell. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight. BellFlight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship. And we look forward to having you back on next week.